exposing the deep state and government overreach. You're with Pella Nuroff-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome to the Pella Nuroff-Taylor show on this Monday spring afternoon. The sky has not fallen on our heads yet. We'll see what happens in the next week or so. We'll be talking about the Iran-Israel conflict with our estimable political editor, Basil Valentine, in a few minutes. But we've got first to give you a window, show you what's on for the rest of the schedule today. We've got five guests on today to kick off after our discussion about the conflict. We talked to two London mayoral candidates, Shion Batra and Piers Corbyn. Have big cities had their day, and is London still great? I grew up in London, so I'm looking forward very much to that conversation. Then at 40 past the hour, we've got Pedro Israel Otto, whom we had on very recently. He's a CIA whistleblower. We'll talk about how the Whistleblower Act instituted after the Snowden affair is actually a joke and misused and abused rather than used to expose intelligence agency wrongdoing. Instead, it's used to take down or try to take down presidents, as we saw with Trump. In the second hour, we've got Fox Green, who's an independent filmmaker, podcaster, and journalist, who, in his new documentary series, Energy Empire, explains how the globalist empire uses food and energy to prevent nation building and ultimately control the world. That's a very interesting take on a perennial subject of the empire ruling over us. If you want to control people, you hit them where it hurts. You hit their food supply and you make them hungry. He'll tell us about that. Our final guest in the second hour is Shankara Chetty, a doctor in South Africa, who discusses how he successfully used a method to treat thousands of patients with COVID, saving them from hospitalization and death, and how South Africa, the state, is targeted because of his treatment, which is surprisingly, well, interesting. Stick around for that. We've got our special news focus session with Basil after this break, but I just want to say something a little bit more scope out and talk about something a little bit more general. I was reading a blog post by a guy called Gilbert Doctorov, who has he's based in Brussels, but he has pays very close attention to the Russian media, and especially the tabloid parts of the Russian media. And indeed, they exist. And there's a program, I think, called 60 Minutes, which very frequently puts out a torrent of anti-Western hatred and propaganda, including the claims that we're run by Satanists and devils. I don't know how literally that should be taken, but I've heard and I've interviewed some people who say there's common paedophilia and paedophilia networks and maybe the Satanist networks among our elites. I won't get into the truth value of that for the moment. I'll just leave it out there. They say it. But Doctorov clearly regards this as Russian disinformation or part of the information warfare to make the Russians pro-war or at least pro-conflict. But then he spends the weekend in a town called Knokke on the Belgian coast. I used to live in Belgium, so I know it well. It's a sort of very bourgeois place, quite well off, on the North Sea coast with all its bad weather. But he describes Belgians and middle class strolling along North Sea beaches and sitting in cafes and diving into the many excellent restaurants. As you may not know, Belgium has excellent food, or excellent French food, I should say. Many, many Michelin-starred restaurants there. He sits around and describes people sitting at the table next to him, clinking beer glasses or glasses of crisp white wine as they gaze out over the spring sunshine. And then he makes a conclusion that certainly, if you read some media, the world, Europe consists of people who are obsessed with war, migration, and transgender, and parts of the media talk about nothing else. And indeed, Viktor Orban, our mole, as it were, inside the European Council, says that European leaders talk about little else but those hot topics. But Dr. Ovin's portrait of Knokke paints a world of two-parent families, nearly all white, normal non-political advertising on the bus hoardings, buses running on times, young couples pushing prams and having up to three children, and people enjoying themselves, having murmuring quiet conversations with friends and family, and behaving as if all is well in the world. And I have to say, I did a trip around Europe from Barcelona to Sweden last year, and I have to say that's my picture of Europe, more or less. And I'm as apt as anyone to be taken in by the stories of everyone obsessed with transgender and immigration rights everywhere and so on. But there are large parts of Europe, maybe 80 or 90%, where in Australia and America can go there and say it's the Europe we always hoped it would look like, with restaurants, cafes, tourists, castles, nice theatre with opera performances, beautiful countryside still. Even though we're supposed to be living in a world of deindustrialization and higher energy prices and all the rest of it, and maybe World War III coming up, that is still much of Europe. So when we look at the media, we in the media, we tend to sort out the noise from the signal. We try to capture the signal rather than the everyday noise. So there's an automatic tendency towards exaggeration, even in the best media, because we're looking at the changes are rather than the constant things. So it's worth bearing in mind that this is still much of Europe. So I just thought I'd put that out there, even as we plunge into the dramatic developments in the Middle East. And of course, on the last day before World War One broke out, there were people enjoying regattas and horse races and all the rest of it. So, I mean, this is not guaranteed in the future, but it is the state of Europe, much of Europe today. Anyway, we're going to have a very, very quick break. And then we've got Basil Valentano, political editor with political and news developments from the Middle East, I think. This is a Pelle Neros Taylor show on TNT Radio. Back after a quick break.
Abroad or at home, this is your news.
By staying silent, we are part of the problem.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neros Taylor Show. We've got Basil Valentine with us, political editor. Anything happening in the world at all, or is it just another sleepy day?
good afternoon, Pelle. Great to see you, and hello to our viewers and listeners all around the world. Well, we're in what some people would call a pregnant pause, a stalemate, with both Israel and Iran claiming Pyrrhic victories of sorts after the weekend's exchanges. The ball is now in the Israelis' court. The war cabinet was due to reconvene a couple of hours ago. I understand that meeting is still going on. There is apparently the will in Israel to retaliate in some way, but the scale, the timing and the exact location and nature of that retaliation is yet to be decided. Meanwhile, finally, sensibly, the likes of David Cameron, Joe Biden, and now Emmanuel Macron are putting pressure on the Israelis not to do anything rash. Macron told the BFM TV news channel a couple of hours ago, "We will do everything to avoid a conflagration, that is to say, an escalation. We need to be by Israel's side to ensure its protection to the maximum, but also to call for a limit to avoid an escalation. The focus should be on isolating Iran, convincing countries in the region that Iran is a danger, increasing sanctions, reinforcing pressure over nuclear activities in Iran," he said. The president also said that French jets had helped repel an Iranian violation of Jordan's airspace during the attack. Yesterday, of course, there was the extraordinary meeting of the Security Council, where the Iranian and Israeli diplomats exchanged insults and called for each other's countries to be sanctioned. We can only hope that that's where the conflict remains, safely in the confines of the UN Security Council in New York, and not a wider war. Worth remembering, one Israeli civilian, a girl, was injured. There were no fatalities. The Daily Mail now says that 12 Iranians were killed in the Israeli bombing of the consulate in Damascus that set in motion this particular train of events. So, the Israelis need to make a calculation. Are they willing to risk World War III, or at least a major conflict with Iran, over injuries to one individual, not even single death?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the Israelis can be incredibly reckless. I mean, and what the last I heard was that I'm wondering if the Americans do have what kind of leverage they have, or whether they're just sitting and passively accepting it. The whole world is hostage to the will of three extremists sitting in the war cabinet. I don't know who's got the casting vote, but I mean, apparently it's Netanyahu holding back. So here we are in a world where Netanyahu is the moderate out of the three people in the war cabinet. And there's a guy called Glantz, I think, who's
Gantz,
said to be
Gantz,
yes. Gantz, yeah. He was a minister. And then there's the Well, you can. What's the defense
Yoav
minister?
Yoav Gallant.
And I was reading yesterday that they were like the two American allies, the moderates. So it's 2-1 against Netanyahu, who wanted an instant strike. But it seems that Gantz was more of a hawk, and he wants a strike straight away before world opinion has coalesced against Israel. And Netanyahu's cautious about that. But it seems to me that the Americans could have a leverage on the Israelis in the sense that they've got, if American efforts prevented Iran from making successful strikes in the terms of the American capabilities, then they can withhold that from the Israelis next time. Not that I'd ever do that, but I mean, I'd heard that that gives them a sort of notional power over Israel. But sometimes Israel seems to me like a spoiled child. Instead of being grateful to the Americans that they cover their asses, you know, at great cost, by the way, because these Americans sent, Iran sent in cheap drones, and these were like, cost millions or even billions to defend against. The Israelis are kind of pocketing that and using their backing, America's backing, to be aggressive against Iran. Typical chutzpah, rather than saying, yeah, America is the power here. They're the ones who saved us. They're I just quickly say, there's a guy called Viktor Ostrovsky, who's a Mossad agent, and he wrote his memoirs. And I was reading it this weekend, and he said the Israelis could have got those hostages free in the 1980s in Beirut, but they didn't bother to because they had fantastic connections inside the Beirut Muslim community. So all those hostages that occupied American attention in the mid-80s. And also the Israelis knew about this big truck bombing in Beirut in 1983 because they also had contacts among the jihadists, and they didn't do anything. So what ally is that? Anyway, I'm totally disregarded, taking the Americans for granted. Anyway, what do you think make of all this?
The Americans spent $1.1 billion on defending Israel at the weekend while America itself crumbles, of course. The UK government has ruled out publishing a legal summary of its actions in defending Israel from an attack by Iran. A spokesman for Sunak, the Prime Minister, said there are no current plans to publish the legal advice, which is in line with long-standing precedent. And well, I would venture to suggest that that precedent is long since outdated. I mean, a lot of people would say, you know, Britain had tangentially, at the very least, engaged in an act of war with Iran by using the RAF and our bases in Cyprus to intercept these drones. You know, at the moment, it really is a game of poker. It's a game of chicken or, well, whatever other metaphor you want. I also want to just draw the parallel between the pinprick that Israel suffered over the weekend against the total obliteration of Gaza. 68 people have been killed in the Middle East over the last 24 hours, most of them shot by an army, shot dead by an army. Hundreds more wounded, victims of artillery shells. Who were those people? They were Palestinians trying to walk from the utterly apocalyptic, hellish conditions in tents in the south back to their homes, or what's left of their homes in the north. And they were picked off like, you know, ants or cockroaches or something by the Israeli military. 68 of them killed. Imagine for a moment, Pelly, 68 Israelis had been killed in the strikes at the weekend by Iran. We'd be in World War III by now. So, you know, have some proportionality.
Well, what I've heard is that the Iranians have a lot of far more missiles. I mean, I was wrong on when we had met on Saturday. I thought that that boat confiscation was going to be the limit, how naive I was. But I was sort of right with saying that the Iranians were quite mild. I mean, they could have done much more. So in a way, it was symbolic. It was carefully coordinated with Americans. They warned Americans 3 days ahead or something. And they sent drones that take 3 hours to get there, you know. So and they didn't send their hypersonic missiles, which apparently they're from Russia.
No, that's right.
But they've
That's
got a lot of stuff, and they could overwhelm, apparently, the Israelis, and they could obliterate Israel and take out with their hypersonic missiles. But of course, Israel has got nukes, So would Israel...
That's right.
Is that the next step after Israel counter-escalates, Iran counter-escalates, and then Israel takes on with the big nukes? I mean, I think Israel is really a rogue state, to be honest. And they have this Samson option, which is almost like an official doctrine, isn't it? And it goes back, and run by religious eschatologists who believe that in end time stuff, you know, it's incredibly scary. Anyway, we'll carry on. We've got to pivot to London and the big issues of the capital city of the UK. But we'll have you on next hour and see if there are any developments on that war cabinet meeting going on in Israel. Anyway, thanks a lot, Basil. Talk to you soon. And we'll go into our first two guests this afternoon. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk Radio.
TNT's Kate Shimarani.
Compulsory house purchase to make way for the immigrants that are coming. So is that going to be David Beckham's house? Is that going to be Gary Lineker's house? Is that going to be some MP's houses? What about that big house that Zelensky, with his khaki gear, you know, 45,000 khaki t-shirts and matching cargo pants, not a bullet hole or shrapnel hole in any of them. Has he purchased Highgrove, 20, whatever it was, 20 million? Are they going to be using all those? What about all those rooms in Buckingham Palace or everywhere else? No, they're probably going to rob the elderly of their homes. So people out there, British people, an Englishman's home is his castle. Are you going to get off your knees yet? I know you're all going down the gym and pumping iron. What's that all about with your tats and your turkey teeth? We need real people to stand up to this.
Kate Shimarani on today's News Talk, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. News Talk Radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT Radio listeners rely on TNT Radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. CO2 sustains all life on Earth, but now it's in long-term decline. We face the return of an ice age. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on this glorious spring afternoon, at least here in Sweden. Now, I'm in Sweden. I was born in, grew up in mostly, and spent most of my life in London. So I'm very pleased to talk to some mayoral guests or mayoral candidate guests for the the elections in London. They're going to elect a new mayor, which is one of the several local-ish elections taking place in the UK in a few weeks. I go back to London sometimes, and the city seems to have lost some of its shine when I go back, my old home city. There's 20-mile speed limits everywhere, which means everything takes much longer. London is a large city geographically. It seems a bit less dynamic and edgy than I remember it, a bit more polished. What I understand from my British side of my family is the British graduates increasingly live in places like Leeds or Bristol, which are smaller and cheaper and more and preferable as lifestyle choices compared to London, which is where international oligarchs park their money. And of course, that does not add life to a place necessarily. Our first guest is, we've got another one coming on, so we've got two of them. But the first guest is mayoral candidate Cheyenne Batra, whom I assume is a great believer in London. We'll test that. He was born in the UK to a father who served in the Indian government. He overcame early hardships after losing both parents in his youth. From an early age, he developed a keen discipline for tenacity and integrity in order to attain success. He started off working for an investment house in London, then transitioned into his own insurance and financial advisory business before transitioning finally into the hotel industry. He's now an independent candidate for mayor. Welcome to the show, Cheyenne Batra. How are you?
It's Sean, by the way, not Cheyenne.
Sean, sorry. People get my name wrong all the time, so I sympathize.
Right. Cheyenne makes me a red Indian. I'm not yet.
How are you?
Working on. Yeah, I'm good. Thank you. Good.
I just looked at your tweets, or you've become sort of high profile on Twitter, mainly for your opposition to 15 Minute Cities. And interestingly, a lot of French tweeters picked up on this because their own experiment with 15-minute cities seemed to be quite popular. So why do you think it's good for Paris but not good for London?
Well, I don't think the Parisians or anybody in the world clearly know what is really happening with the 15-minute cities. If I can elaborate, I've studied this since about 2020, 2021, when it first started shaking its head out through the COVID period and the vaccines. As the vaccines never got through to people and penetrate and put them under the ground, the next thing now is to create these small incubine type of cities that are nowhere near what you think they're going to be, like a smart city. They're going to be a controlled city. And they have to do a controlled environment because there are too many people, as you know. Cities are very vibrant with 5-10 million people in them. It's a great place to start. And in January 26th, I believe, about 11:10 in the morning, all the councils in England have signed up to this 15-minute city. So when you look at the Parisians and the others, they're feeling they're going to embrace it, but it's not what they think it's going to be. I've spoken to a few mayors across the globe, and they don't actually know what it is. They've got the money. Money's been paid by the WEF, who are the controllers of this scheme. It starts with a chair in London. And basically, these cities are created so that if you violate anything that they tell you not to do, your bank accounts will be frozen. That's a
Can threat. I just ask, so what does the average mayor think a 15-minute city is? In fact, I barely know what it is. And what is it really?
Well, whilst I've been out on my campaign, I've spoken to everybody, all the people I've had to speak to. The first thing I said, by the way, do you know what C40 is, 15-minute city? No, what is it? The thing is this, that if you've got a mayor that is supposed to serve the public and protect them, look after them as their own guardian, then it's your duty to tell the country what you're up to in your plan that you have set up. If it's been hidden, it's only a matter of time that that plan gets opened up and people start looking at it. But I mean, at first I thought it was conspiracy stuff, and there wasn't much on in those days, but there is a lot on now. And the real truth is that this is going to be a control. Unfortunately, you can't get to China, but there are 600 million cameras looking at you now in China. Face recognition, CBDC, you name it, it's in. And you've also noticed that passports, when you start to travel, you won't be needing one because they're going to recognize you where you are. So this is all the commencement of the 15-minute city. And in London, the biggest hurdle of all is that most people have seen the 20-mile-hour lanes, like you said. The 20-mile lanes are designed to get you into the world of what they're going to be planning to do. And the problem is this, that when I was out on the road, I went, do you know Hackney? Do you know where Hackney is?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Okay. I went to Hackney, where we had to get lots of names from all the boroughs. And I met some lovely people there. And this one particular road was kind of blocked off to cars. And so the ladies who I spoke to, they had big gardens at the back, and they go shopping. And they said, please, why can we not get to the back of our house? Because I park my car there, and I park and I get my food and stuff, and I bring it into the house. It takes them 20 minutes to get to the back of their house, to park their car and to take their food into their home. I mean, this is kind of happening everywhere now. The roads are being blocked, and I don't know how long you've been back or not, but for the last few years, the same roads I see are just blocked. There's just no excuse for it. And I don't know how they're going to create these so-called cities in our London. London is quite a small city, but large in many ways, as you know. But the goal is to put people into a place where they can only work in that city. Now, the thing is, if you've got businesses outside, etc., how do you get there? You're not going to get there. You either got to bring those businesses into this city or you've got to work here.
Okay, we can explore that in just a second. I mean, I'm an ex-Londoner, and as it were, and I was there last year, but I haven't been back this year since. We're going to go into the a very quick news summary of the dramatic developments in the world, and then we're coming back to talk about London and the upcoming mayoral election. This is the Pelinero's Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. Back after a break.
TNT Radio News.
News break!
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. The White House has stated that the United States will not participate in any counterstrike should Israel decide to retaliate following an attack on its territory by Iran. Quebec has experienced significant flooding due to heavy rainfall this week, particularly affecting rivers north of Montreal and in Quebec City. In Saint-Jérôme, located approximately 50 kilometers northwest of Montreal, officials reported major flooding on the Rivière du Nord.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. For the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations, vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelinero Taylor Show. We're talking about the London mayor elections with Sean Bartra, who's an independent candidate for these elections, which are coming up very shortly, I think in two or three weeks, and they every 4 years, and it's a very high profile and important post. Sean, you're telling us about what if you vote for the current order, you will get a sort of ordered world, a bit like the one in China, where you're going to be these 15-minute city, which sounds like a sort of glorious possibility of living and working in your own suburb and going down to get some baguettes and then sitting in a nice cafe and not spending your time in long car journeys, is basically a sort of system for almost jailing us in certain areas and then potentially needing permission to leave it. And all this will be monitored by cameras or CCTV type cameras. And you flesh out that a little bit, because it does sound very dystopian, and it's good that you're highlighting it, even if it sounds abstract at the moment. We can't be too careful about these things, because we know that our leaders are not necessarily to be trusted.
Yes, that's correct.
So what? Talk a little bit about this 20 mile an hour limit. That's 30 kilometers for Europeans an hour. That's a very slow speed. How much of London? Yeah.
Sorry. So it's actually in the suburbs as well. I was driving down Finchley Road and it's 20 mile an hour, the whole of Finchley Road, literally. You go to, before the expansion, the M25, most of the cameras were not there, as you know, and because the expansion happened, and I believe it's going to happen even more because he's going to go to Blackwall Tunnel, dig out a route for Silver Street, put a charge on there for £4, put a 20 mile hour city on there, a driving system, which is ludicrous because, first of all, it slows down everyone. And yesterday, I think I left Hyde Park and I went down towards the city. All of the tunnels are jam packed. This is a Sunday. I mean, the city normally is closed pretty much on a Sunday. No one really goes there apart from tourists. But the roads were just completely jammed. It took me 40 minutes to get out of one part of Temple all the way down to Tower Bridge. Now, these are the controls that they're bringing in. So people are controlled in their cars. The idea is to get rid of these cars, as you know. No petrol or diesel, only electric. Now, if you convert this all into electricity across the globe, you're going to blow the terminals up. There's not enough electricity to charge everyone's cars. And then if you violate anything, those cars will be able to turn around, either take you back to your house or to the nearest police station or the violation station, they're going to call it. And there is also something like Project Detroit. Do you know anything about this?
No.
Have you heard of Project Detroit? Okay. Project Detroit is your camera's pay per mile. He now wants you to pay by the mile as you drive, pay as you go. I mean, this is ludicrous. We originally, as you've lived in England, you'll probably remember that when you have a car, you pay road tax, £300 a year. And that gives you opportunity to drive where you like. Now, that's not happening. That's being paid for. These £15 and congestion charge, ULEZ charge, the useless charge, which I intend, I get back in as mayor, we will discuss this after, that is going to go, the money's going to go back to the public because it's an unnecessary charge. There is no need to keep charging people left, right, and center to drive. It's their privilege to drive. They get a car, and what do you do? Now, it's gone into the suburbs. It's all over the suburbs. So if you're walking, if you're in your 15-minute city and you say to your wife, well, let's go shop, let's go walk down to Sainsbury's and get some grub, you'll be walking down there, you're going to get a text message. They're going to know what you're going to have because they're going to tell you what you're going to eat. You probably heard that these processed meats are being prepared now. I believe somehow, somewhere in England, it's already starting that they're bringing these genetic meats in. And I certainly never would touch it because I don't know what's going into that food. And food is going to be a consumption where you may be controlled. Remember the vaccines. We were told that things were put into the vaccines. And now I read this morning that there are more cancers than ever before after the vaccine had come out. So for me, I am not a fan of this. And when I spoke to some of the mayors around the world, I discriminately called them and I said, I'm running for mayor of London. It's my opportunity to speak with you as well. You get to know who I am. And I win, then I will be talking to you. But do you know what C40 is? No. How do you mean you don't know what C40 is? C40 is your 15-minute cities that you guys have signed up to. I particularly picked out several mayors because I wanted to see if they knew what this was about or is it just the money thing? As far as I know, the WEF have paid out this money to these men, and they have teamed up. His job in London is to get all the mayors around the world on his side. So if everybody works into that momentum, the whole world is going to get into this cocoon cities, I call it. There is no smartness about it. I mean, if you look into Saudi now, they're making the line. I mean, the line is going to be a 15-mile long city, you can call it. You're never going to get out. And so it's not a conspiracy. I always wanted to speak about this at the very end of the election because it's important to get the message across to the public and say, look, guys, you really got to wake up and see what is ahead of the road. You know, when the traffic lights go green, you go, but where are you going to? Because slowly, slowly, the idea is to condense you into this city. Then your businesses are going to dramatically fall and fail. And a lot of the businesses will fall. You'll be working for the state. This is what is going to be the ultimate goal. It may be a five-year thing. It may be a three-year thing. I don't know the term of time. But what I do know is that if you could get an eyeball into China, because they closed all of the, you can't find anything in China, really. It's shut door. You know, but it's happening there. It's moving.
So, Sean, that's incredibly interesting. And it's very, I mean, let's say there might be some skeptics, but it's very useful that you're painting this possible dystopia that we, people can take a stance on it and then we're not ambushed or surprised. And you bring it up for debate because our world is going to look different in 20 or 30 years' time or even in 10 years' time. And it's good that you're placing it out there because otherwise these things will creep us on us by stealth. And you are certainly, Sadiq Khan, who's the current mayor, has been doing worrying things. He doesn't seem to care for liberty very much. He's talking about this vegetarian diet that we all have to adopt. He's got these 20-mile limits. He's got this speed camera thing. This is a ULEZ, low emissions zone camera, which a lot of freedom-loving Brits are now busy sabotaging. So there are interesting things going on there. And London is one of the world's premier cities. It's an obvious coup for those forces who want to position us into being a less free people and controlled. I'm sorry we're going to have to end there, but incredibly interesting. And I wish you the best of luck and also with your various debates, because it's certainly not boring and it certainly could be well be true and very interesting. Sorry, we've got to wind up there. Just one last question. So if you don't win, because it's probably going to go to one of the main parties, what are you going to do next? Are you going to carry on fighting? Very quickly.
I don't know. I've got many plans. I was hoping that Piers would come onto the show with me.
We'll have him on. Something happened with his internet, but we could talk about that another time. Okay. Sean Batra, London Mayor as candidate. Sorry, we've got to go there. London Mayor candidate. We'd love to have you on very shortly again. Very interesting and best of luck. And thank you for painting a dystopian picture of my old home city, not heading back there very soon. This is the Pelle Neros Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. We'll be back after the break. Thank you very much.
It's been said that when someone you love has Parkinson's, you have Parkinson's. The truth is, Parkinson's disease doesn't just affect the diagnosed. It affects everyone who supports and helps care for them. Worldwide, over 10 million people are living with Parkinson's, a neurological disease that affects movement. And with so many places to search for information, it can be difficult to know where to begin. The Parkinson's Foundation has answers. Answers for everyone in the fight. We can help you understand the disease, help you find expert care, give you tips for living a better life, share the latest research, help you find local support, and there's a free helpline you can call. Find your answers and join us in the fight against Parkinson's. To learn more, please go to parkinson.org or call 1-800-4PD-INFO. The Parkinson's Foundation. Better lives together.
Around here, bushfire is just a part of life. We've been through it before, and we'll get through it again. The people here all look out for each other. We're a community that does its bit to plan and prepare, to keep everyone safe. We live with bushfire, so we live bushfire ready.
Propaganda versus the truth. You're with Swedish-British journalist Pelle Neroth Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on this Monday afternoon. Some people you talk to, you wish you could talk to them again because the conversation was only half finished and they obviously had so many interesting things to say more. And what a perfect example that was Pedro Israel Otto, whom we had on very recently. So we thought, well, let's have him on again. He's the, for you, those of you who did not listen last time, he's the Miami-born son of Cuban immigrants who fled Fidel Castro and his wicked communism. He worked for 18 years for the CIA and having served in Iraq, Afghanistan, and another place in the Middle East, which he can't tell us about. And he was at the Inspector General Intelligence Community working on whistleblowers issues. He himself then tried to become a whistleblower, and his great disappointment with the way his case was treated led him to write a book about the whole experience called The Whistle is Broken. Welcome back to the show, Pedro.
Thank you, Pelle, for having your show again this afternoon.
I was just listening to the archive of our last talk, and we didn't get to speak about this guy, this Ukrainian guy, Vindman. So maybe we can pick up our last conversation at that point, because he was one of those guys who flutters into the news cycle a few years ago and was on everyone's lips, or at least all political junkies' lips, and he's kind of been forgotten now. But can you tell us about that case and his kind of war on Trump and whether he was a real whistleblower or a fake whistleblower?
Here's something that's very important for people to realize. Anytime a U.S. president is having a telephone call conversation with any foreign leader, there's a plethora of people behind the scenes listening into the phone call. The National Security Council, Department of State, so forth. And in this particular case, a Army officer loaned out detail to the National Security Council, Alexander Vindman, and his brother, a lawyer, also was working at the National Security Council. They're both Army officers detailed to the National Security Council. Alexander Vindman heard the conversation that President Trump had with the president of Ukraine. And Vindman, did not like the conversation because it challenged his personal feelings on how the president should be conducting foreign relations with the Ukraine. the conversation was essentially about investigating corruption related to the Bidens. So what happened here was Vindman wasn't in the capacity of an intelligence community employee. So he could not directly use the Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act process to disclose what he reasonably believed evidence wrongdoing. Anyone who witnesses something and believes that it's wrong by law, policy, procedures, or so forth, can report these matters. And there's a mechanism in place in which you must be an intelligence community employee. You must report to what's known as authorized officials through these authorized channels. So apparently, he leaked details of the conversation to another individual, potentially known as Eric Ciriamella. And it was Eric Ciriamella, reportedly, who filed an Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act disclosure with the Office of the Office of the Inspector General for the Intelligence Community. But, you know, when the issue was reviewed by the lawyers working national security issues at the Directorate of National Intelligence, they determined that, wait a moment, you know, this is really nothing to do about intelligence activities or under the authorities of the Director of National Intelligence. So this process demands that the Inspector General pass it to the Director of National Intelligence, who then is by law required to pass it to Congress within no later than 3 weeks after receiving the disclosure. And what happened here was the DNI said, no, this is not a disclosure. And the Inspector General disagreed, and he violated the law by tipping off Congress that there was a disclosure out there against President Trump. And in this entire process, other issues were actually unearthed, discovered, where they changed the policies and the procedures. Instead of being a firsthand requirement as far as direct knowledge, they changed it, watered it down to hearsay, which I myself, when I processed some of these disclosures, they were firsthand. They didn't even bother processing them. They basically discarded them. They didn't even respond to me. So my point is, Alexander Vindman, by law, was not a whistleblower, did not have any whistleblower protections pertaining to the Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act. And more importantly, the political operatives within the government and Congress were trying to weaponize this Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act process to target Trump for impeachment. And eventually, that's what they did.
Because it seems to me that the whistleblower is about pointing out abuses of the intelligence community. But this was basically a guy who just didn't like what President Trump, and President Trump is the chief of America. He can do whatever that foreign policy damn well wants. It's not up to some minion to decide whether his personal feelings are offended by it. And then he weaponizes this thing, as you said, and it goes to Congress. And then it leaks, I guess, and then it takes on its own momentum as it becomes a media story. And then you can always rely on the New York Times and the Washington Post to totally distort it anyway. So it becomes then an issue about Trump, doesn't it? It basically becomes an intelligence takedown of or a minion, this guy Vindman, who has his deep state connections, of Trump because they don't like his Russia and Ukraine foreign policy. But that's not their business. They're only colonels or whatever. It's Trump's business. Is that right?
That is correct. Basically, it all started with you might as well call him disgruntled, didn't like it, and okay, I'm going to blow the whistle. I'm going to take down this president. But, you know, he had allies, lawyers in the Washington, D.C. area, the Democratic congressman, and most certainly, as you pointed out, the Washington Post, New York Times, the liberal media establishment. So they all ganged up against President Trump, trying to use this process to target what the Department of Justice for the United States determined that had nothing to do about intelligence activities. And it was more about foreign relations, which the President of the United States, per the U.S. Constitution, has basically the authorities to conduct foreign relations. It's not Congress. And for that matter, it's not the executive branch of the government telling the president what to do. but it's the president leading the executive branch of the government. And this gets into, well, how does the U.S. government work? I mean, we have a lot of entrenched interest in the executive branch of government that tries to run the president and tell the president what to do. And that in itself is really not the way the government is supposed to work.
Mm. So this Vindman guy, and of course, in the democratic West, we're sort of brought up on this idea. So when you say the word of whistleblower, they have a sort of patina around them, a sort of a glow of heroic glow. So didn't the newspapers talk up this guy, this jumped up colonel who's trying to boss around his president as some kind of truth hero?
He was glorified as a truth teller and received all the protections, the attention that he could possibly get. They literally pulled out a red carpet for him. While the truth is that real whistleblowers in the intelligence community who blew the whistle on internal wrongdoing received basically, the kicked in the butt, kicked out, fired, destroyed. And for that matter, never received any attention or protections at all whatsoever from Congress or for that matter, even the press.
So remind an audience, because I don't demand of my listeners to listen to every episode. Some of those, you yourself were a real whistleblower. Tell us what the infamy or the unfortunate neglect that real whistleblowers received.
I mean, from my end, I had basically two rounds of whistleblowing and two rounds of reprisals. You know, as a U.S. government employee, you are required by federal laws to report to the authorities, your supervisory chain of command, all the way up to the director of the agency, and even oversight bodies in Congress, report anything that violates the law or that is a significant endangerment to public safety, gross abuses of power, fraud, waste, so forth. I blew the whistle on significant and specific endangerment to public safety when I was in a war zone as a manager. Our lives were endangered by some of the actions of my superior. I was a manager, but my superior above me was doing some really reckless things. And for that matter, there were some equal employment opportunity harassment issues of subordinates under us, which I reported. So these are all known as protected disclosures. You report wrongdoing, it's a protected disclosure. You're a truth teller, a whistleblower in this process. And sadly, as we pointed out earlier, if you ever blow the whistle on their dirty laundry, they're going to try to sweep you away into the garbage can and see to it that the truth never gets out. And that's what happened to me. So in this process, I uncovered that the whistle was broken, that the actual process to blow the whistle and receive protections, it's non-existent. On paper, it is certain, but the reality is the implementation doesn't exist. And more importantly, when I worked for the Office of Inspector General for the Intelligence Community, I was part of a team that evaluated these reprisal protections. And we found that indeed, there's protections on paper, but the implementation is sorely lacking. So at that point in time, given that I had received reprisals, my case never really did anything as far as resolving it. I ended up blowing the whistle on the broken whistle to leaders of the intelligence community and the congressional oversight committees. And ultimately, nobody did anything about it other than sweep it under the rug, kick me out, and fire me.
You're the kind of American that everyone wants. I mean, you're the best kind of American. You take it seriously. You're trying to sort of, in your way, as a guy inside the machine, to kind of clean up the deep state or clean up the swamp or whatever you want to call it. And then you're fired for that. What happened to you and your family after this? Did you have any, what was the impact on your life and your family?
The most significant impact here was I had a foreign national wife that became a U.S. citizen. We were a single household income with a young daughter, 4, 5, 6. Some things happened in a prior tour that caused a lot of separation. Finally, when we're getting, trying to get established, I'm relying on my job and my overseas job for the extra income that I needed for my family, for some special needs for my daughter, needs for my wife at the time. And all that was ripped off from me, stolen from me. So it hurt my ability to help my family. And ultimately, it led to our separation. And sadly, my daughter had to relocate back to the foreign country where her mother is from. And in this entire process, it has caused a lot of pain for my daughter, separation from my daughter. I mean, it hurt me as a father, as a husband, as a provider for my family. And, you know, I have to deal with this separation constantly. And, you know, every time I see my daughter, you know, she's always crying, you know, when I'm saying goodbye to her. And this was all unnecessary because all I did was follow the law, report what I needed to report, and their duty was to protect me. If they didn't like what I reported, that's a different issue. But they had no right to take reprisals against me that affected my family. And I made it easy for them to fix it. Just give me a job that helps me and my family, that, you know, that get my career moving along, that meets all our needs, and we're good. You know, I can care less if you resolve the problem or not. That's for you. My duty is to report. Whether you want to fix it or not, that's your problem. But don't take reprisals against me that affects my family. That's wrong.
You're talking here about specific cases of what happened to you, but have you any thoughts about this kind of unaccountable deep state or swamp, you want to call it, how it, unless we have people like yourselves embedded in the system, it can actually lead us to kind of tyranny?
It certainly can. I mean, there are other whistleblowers out there. There is a case of one whistleblower by the name of John Reedy, who blew the whistle of some serious problems that may have cost the lives of dozens of assets. And now look at the Snowden case. Snowden is right. The abuse of power weaponized against the American people by the surveillance state is significant. And in his particular case, he knew the process wouldn't work, so he chose to disclose it publicly. But despite the fact that he has disclosed it publicly, here we are today having a vote at Capitol Hill, Washington, D.C., in Congress about these FISA authorities that allow the government to weaponize its surveillance powers against political dissent. And if we don't fix the broken whistle, the means of being able to disclose wrongdoing and at the same time find a fix to the things that is disclosed wrong, I mean, it's a spiral down effect. I like what Liz Truss said, that the West has like 10 years to, you know, basically save itself from destruction. And you can look no further than countries like Venezuela that were very prosperous in the Western Hemisphere in Latin America. No, it took us one dictator to come in. And, you know, a dictator doesn't necessarily have to be a communist or a conservative. A dictator is somebody who is going to crush political dissent. He came in, Chavez, and his one to follow Maduro, and they literally destroyed that country. Where all the wealth has
Pedro,
been gone.
We've got a minute and a half left. Can you just sort of say just say a little bit about this thing, this FISA thing that was passed? In what way is that tyrannical? And then finally, to conclude, could you just say where we can find you and where we can find your book? And then we'll have to terminate.
If the U.S. government can determine through questionable means, even if it's made up, that you are a counterintelligence threat or counterterrorism threat, that can put the full force of government surveillance to track you in your every move, financial, physical, phone, computer, whatever. And they can use that against you to even entrap you and persecute you and falsely prosecute you, as they've done to others like General Flynn. And you can find me at Pedro Israel Horta and most social media like Twitter, my website, pedroisraelhorta.com, and the book website, brokenwhistlebook.com.
Okay. Well, I'll just conclude it. We have had a fascinating conversation, and presumably there won't be, we've got a minute left, any accountability. There won't be any judges will just sign off on this counterintelligence formality. So basically, we're entering into a new age of a surveillance state where right-thinking Americans, you know, I mean, I've already been shocked and heard about these political prisoners who've been jailed for protesting peacefully about abortion. Or similarly, this whole J6 stuff, which just seems ridiculous. But this gives extended powers, more extensive powers than existed previously, to track down and chase that kind of, well, in my view, kind of right-thinking Americans. You'd say that was correct.
That is exactly. Yeah. Okay. It's just
Pedro,
unfettered,
Fantastic to have you on. Just check him out on Twitter, Pedro Israel Orta, and you can look up his book, The Whistle is Broken, A True Whistleblower and American Hero, if you want to talk about those things in those emotional terms. And I highly recommend that you check those things out. And this is the Pelle Neroff Taylor Show. We're going to go into our second hour and dramatic developments in Israel and the Iranian conflict going on there. Thank you very much, Pedro. See you soon. This is the Pelle Neroff Taylor Show on this Monday afternoon.